I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio. The Tea Party is a phenomenon of modern American politics, and it started in 2009 when a commentator on CNBC went on a rant about the Fed bailing out underwater mortgages. But soon the Tea Party was branded as anti-big government with a serious libertarian streak. In her new book, Harvard professor Theda Skocpol has written a comprehensive analysis of what the Tea Party really means for the people who make it up and how they're influencing the Republican Party at large. And Theda Skocpol, author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, thanks so much for coming in.
Well, it's nice to be here.
So let's talk about that birth of the Tea Party, because I think that's really interesting. I'm going to play Rick Santilli, who's a commentator on CNBC, was then, still is now. You can see him every morning. And here he is in early 2009. Obama had just been elected. We're in the middle of sort of financial turmoil. And he has this complaint that the Tea Party really latches on to about mortgages. Let's listen.
You know, the government is promoting bad behavior because we certainly don't want to put stimulus forth and give people a whopping $8 or $10 in their check and think that they ought to save it. And in terms of modifications, I'll tell you what, I have an idea. You know, the new administration's big on computers and technology. How about this, President and new administration? Why don't you put up a website to have people vote on the internet as a referendum to see if we really want to subsidize the losers' mortgages, or would we like to at least buy cars and buy houses in foreclosure and give them to people that might have a chance to actually prosper down the road, and reward people that could carry the water instead of drink the water?
Theda Skocpol, when you hear him talking about, you know, that we should not subsidize losers' mortgages, what was it about this rant that really awakened the Tea Party?
Well, Santilli, in that same rant, called for Tea Party protests, and he invoked the Founding Fathers to link them to these this outburst of complaints about helping the people who drink the water rather than carry the water, which is a very Tea Party-type phrase. So it was the rant as a whole and the linking of it to that iconic American Revolutionary imagery that really gave it its oomph.
And let's listen, actually, to the little bit where he says, let's have a Tea Party.
This is America. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills? Raise their hand.
How about we all?
President Obama, are you listening? We're thinking of having a Chicago Tea Party in July. All you capitalists that want to show up to Lake Michigan, I'm going to start organizing.
So was this immediate that people jumped on this and said, yeah, I mean, what is wrong with people that they bought houses that are too big and they can't afford them and I'm not bailing these people out?
Well, you know, it was a spark that was put on a pile of very dry straw. And that pile of very dry straw consisted of conservative-minded Americans who were very upset already about the election of President Obama and the appearance of all Democrats in control of both houses of Congress in the midst of an economic meltdown. And they had been angry at their own political party, the Republicans, too. So they weren't about to turn to the Republican Party as a vehicle directly of protest. They were looking for another kind of rallying cry. And I think the Santilli rant actually helped to create a label. It got repeated again and again on the internet and on TV and on radio. And the press secretary at the White House actually commented on it, which was probably a big tactical mistake from Obama's perspective. And it just got around. And we went out a year later and interviewed people. People said that they'd heard that, not necessarily the first time, but when it was repeated.
And was it just the part of it where he says Tea Party that really people caught on to and said, gee, we've really gotten away from our founding, from the kinds of things that Thomas Jefferson would be saying and Ben Franklin? Or was it that idea of what's up with these freeloaders who are trying to get us to help them out with whatever, any kind of social program?
Absolutely. I mean, the use of the word losers, of people who are going to drink the water rather than carry the water, those are ways of talking about social resentments directed against what we're being presented. This is not factual necessarily, but we're being presented as people just mooching off the American taxpayer, minorities in many cases. That's the implication that many of the listeners would have heard in that anger.
So you talked about that there was, that this rant hit a bunch of very dry kindling. And I know in the book you sort of say that for a lot of people, not for everybody certainly, but for some people, the Obama presidency, at least initially, was pretty scary.
Oh, very much so.
Why? What was scary about it? And I also wonder if it is still scary to people.
Oh, yes, it is. Well, you know, I did this book with a co-author, Vanessa Williamson, and we, when we began to study the phenomena a little over a year after this rant occurred, we were curious. I mean, we wanted to understand where this came from, how it got organized, and where the intense anger and fear-tinged anger directed against a president who actually is kind of mild in many ways. So a lot of what we did when we talked to grassroots activists was to try to understand what was so upsetting to them. And the best way I can put it is, in liberal Massachusetts, when George W. Bush was either elected to the presidency or appointed by the Supreme Court, depending on how you look at it, a lot of people were very upset. They were angry. They were afraid because somebody culturally and politically very different from them, backed by Republicans in both houses of Congress, that's important here, was going to be in charge of their country. Well, that same feeling was there when 2 million young people were in Washington cheering on Obama. And Democrats were arriving. And these are, it turns out that the Tea Party people are already very conservative-minded people.
And it didn't feel like their country.
It felt like somebody else was in charge. And mm-hmm. and added edge to that comes that it was a moment of political and economic crisis.
So when you talk to the people who are in the Tea Party, and I know you went sort of all over the country and looked at different groups, including here in Massachusetts, what were their main issues? Were there, you know, when they said, like, I really have issues with Obama being president, he doesn't feel like my president, what were the things they really didn't like about him?
Yeah. Well, we were very interested in that. And I should say that what we did ultimately was to interview one-on-one in confidential settings activists in Massachusetts and in Virginia and in Arizona. We also observed meetings. We attended local meetings of Tea Party people. And so especially in the interviews, we were kind of interested in letting them talk. So our questions were very soft. Things like, how did you hear about the Tea Party? How did you get involved? Excuse me. And later we would get to the question of, well, what do you mean when you say you're upset about the government doing too much? And what would they name? Well, they would always name Obamacare, the health care reform. They didn't usually mention mortgages, but they would certainly talk about this idea of freeloaders were going to get, that Obama was going to be doing things for freeloaders or moochers. And so we wanted to know who are the moochers and the freeloaders, and we let people talk. And undocumented immigrants, illegal immigrants, very big. In fact, I would probably say at the grassroots of the Tea Party, that's the most intense. The feeling that the country is being invaded by people who, if you listen, turn out to be Latino, who are taking taxpayer-funded services. But in addition, you would hear stories about welfare that sound very much like conservative themes for a long time and were clearly referring to African Americans. And then finally, the most interesting, young people. The idea that the government might start doing things for young people, sometimes like their grandniece or nephew or their grandchild who was just staying at home and didn't have a job. So I think this fear that somebody was going to take from us, the hardworking, lifelong taxpayers, and give to these others who are asking for something for nothing.
We're talking with Theda Skocpol, the author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. I wonder, when you talk to these people, did you ever ask them, or did you ever get a sense of whether they themselves received any sort of government assistance? Were they on disability? Did they get welfare, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever?
Well, yes. And in fact, some of them, in a few cases, had had a history of being on direct welfare payments. But these are mainly older white conservative people. And by older, I mean overwhelmingly over 50, and a lot of them over 60 or 65. So they were either getting Social Security or Medicare benefits or about to. And in many cases, especially in Virginia, they might be getting military veterans benefits. So we did eventually ask people about that because, the interviews were gentle and soft and mainly consisted of us listening. That's what we were there for. But, you know, I would eventually say that, you know, the most expensive things the government spends its money on are defense and veterans benefits, Social Security and Medicare. What do you think of those? And we only found one person out of quite a few that we interviewed who criticized those programs. Their expense wasn't the issue. It was that they had been earned. And in that sense, Tea Partiers are just like other Americans. They think these are good programs that go to people who've earned them through a lifetime of work.
So they didn't necessarily, they are not necessarily big proponents of cutting Social Security and gutting Medicare.
Well, that's the irony. I mean, I don't know how many people that we interviewed at the grassroots necessarily knew that this is where most of the federal government's money is going. I mean, they were imagining Obamacare to be a huge transfer, and many of them had heard the ads that said it would cut Medicare to give health care to people that they think of as undeserving. But I'm not sure, you know, they told us that they watch Fox up to 6 to 8 hours a day. And on Fox, you're not going to get the impression that these are the expensive programs. You're going to get the impression that the federal government is spending and wasting a lot of money on freeloaders or on bloat.
Well, interestingly, I wonder even if people always were in touch with the fact that Social Security, for example, is a government program. I know Simon Johnson, who's an economist at MIT and has been the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, has said that an astonishing number, it might be 40% of people, do not realize when they get a Social Security check that it's coming from the government. They think it's their money that's been held in an account for them, that they contributed it, you know, 20 years ago, right? And it's been held for them. Did you get any sense that people didn't necessarily think of Social Security as a government program?
I'd be interested in where he got that information. I'm not sure that that is correct. Most of the people we interviewed did know mm-hmm. that these programs come out of the federal budget, out of the trust fund in any event, and that they, I don't think they thought there was a separate place where their money had been kept. They talked about Social Security as something you paid into, but that's not necessarily people thinking it's in a separate account. I think that's people thinking, I pay taxes all my life. I worked all my life. I earned this. So I don't want to make fun of them or suggest that they didn't believe these are government-funded programs. I think they know that.
And do you think, is your sense at all, as the Obama presidency has gone on, and certainly we're coming to the end of the first term, or maybe the end of the whole thing, but that people have become less scared of him, or the same level of fear exists?
Well, I think Tea Party people are in a permanent state of anxiety and fear about this president and about the Democratic Party more generally. The Democratic Party was described in one meeting I attended as an alliance of criminals who are trying to get welfare illegally, professors, liberal professors, bad category, who enable that, government workers who are trying to take from the taxpayer, and people who are trying to help illegal immigrants become legal so that they can reelect a president who wouldn't get support from real Americans. So the Democratic Party itself is an object of contempt and hatred and fear in these circles. Tea Party people are not enthusiastic about Mitt Romney, I can tell you that. But that doesn't matter. They are enthusiastic about getting rid of Barack Obama, so they will vote for whoever appears to have any chance of doing that.
Right. And I actually want to talk to you about some new polls and what we're seeing in terms of Mitt Romney and where the Tea Party is pushing the GOP. But first, I've got to touch on something you said about that liberal professors are part of the base of the Democratic Party. Did you, when you were interviewing people in different parts of the country, did you whisper real quietly that you were a professor from Harvard?
Well, they all knew that.
Okay.
I mean, you know, you can't go to interview people without being pretty honest about who you are. They knew that there was a liberal professor and a graduate student from Harvard, and they would sometimes make a joke about that, but at least the ones that were willing to eventually have us visit and talk with them, and some just looked me up on the internet and, you know, brushed it off. But face-to-face, people were polite. And, of course, we were, too. We were very careful to show respect for their citizen participation, and we were all ears. And we didn't, in no way did we share our own political views. And they didn't show any curiosity about them either.
We're talking about the Tea Party, and we're going to talk more about how it's impacting the Republican Party today and what issues are really motivating them right now. I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Tea Party, the political movement that took off in 2009 and has made major waves in our political landscape ever since. And here with me in Studio 3 is Theda Scotchpole, a professor at Harvard and author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. And Theda, I want to go to Massachusetts, which was a major player. Interestingly, you wouldn't think blue Massachusetts, but it really was. So I'm going to play you a little clip of David Axelrod, an advisor to President Obama, and he's reacting here to sort of the rise of the Tea Party and the fact that it was able to carry Scott Brown over the finish line.
I think there's a lot of frustration, Charlie, about Washington, and I don't think it's aimed at one party alone. There is a sense that for too long in Washington, special interests have been too powerful. Politicians have been too self-interested and worried about elections, and there has been too much partisanship. You look at the polling that was done after the Massachusetts race, and that was really the message that people were delivering. More than half of them said, this was not a message to President Obama. They were less charitable toward the Congress, but they were unhappy with Republicans and Democrats in Congress. And
there was a giant perception in the Tea Party that health care reform, as making its way through Congress, was too much government and too costly.
Well, interesting.
That was the perception.
The interesting thing, since we're on Massachusetts, is, of course, that much of what we're doing is patterned on the Massachusetts plan that Governor Romney passed and Senator Brown voted for, and 68% of the people in the exit polls in that Massachusetts race said they like that plan.
Theda Scotchpole, I wonder what you make of the David Axelrod analysis, which is they weren't really mad at the Democrats. They were mad at the government, at special interests. What do you think?
Well, you know, David Axelrod was whistling in the dark a little bit there. That we have to take ourselves back. I mean, it was a low turnout special election. It was definitely not a repudiation of Obama, but a lot of Obama supporters stayed home in that election. Martha Coakley made a lot of mistakes. She really did. And that opened the door. But the Scott Brown, victory came at a moment when health care reform was being negotiated in Washington for the end game. There were all kinds of things like Ben Nelson of Nebraska negotiating a special Cornhusker kickback. And the outside forces that came in on behalf of Brown with big money ran ads that played on that resentment. Plus, a lot of union workers in Massachusetts were at that moment worried that the Obama administration was going to tax their health plans to pay for this. So there's no question that this was a moment where the forces aligned to give the Republicans an opening. And the Tea Party at that point supported Brown. They don't really like him much anymore. But it was a chance to give a blow to the Democrats in Washington, and it was the Democrats it was aimed at. No question about that.
Right. Now, people talk about the Tea Party as being a grassroots movement, and I think in a lot of ways it is, but I also wonder, certainly it got support early on from Fox News, although it seemed like Rupert Murdoch at some point said, oh yeah, we need to back off a little bit. And then you talk in the book about the Koch brothers being maybe not intricately involved, but in some ways laying some of the foundation. So is this a grassroots movement? Is this a you know, a turf movement? What is it?
Well, we asked that question, and here's the answer we ultimately came up with. And we used, by the way, every kind of evidence. Evidence on national organizations, funding patterns, Congress, polls, and our interviews with grassroots people, which were very valuable. The Tea Party's not one thing. It was a kind of dynamic interplay of three forces, all of which hated Obama, wanted him out, and wanted to oppose Democrats. But grassroots activism was quite genuine, and it was probably motivated by these older white conservatives' fears of a changing society, as well as their hatred of Democrats. But then you have Fox News, which during the first six months played a very important role because it was a cheerleader for this. It, you know, put it on, made a big deal of it when it was a little bit, and told people where to go to hook up with others, which is important for any nascent social movement.
Right, Sean Hannity would attend events, right?
Yeah, and then later, when they decided that this label was no longer helpful, then they're not mentioning it this year. But that was all very strategic at the beginning. And then there are what we call the roving billionaire-backed national advocacy and funding organizations, which were predated the Tea Party. They have been pushing a deregulate business and cut taxes again and again and again and again and again on billionaires and block environmental things and block health care. Those are agendas they've had for a long time, including privatizing Social Security and Medicare. But they saw an opening when this grassroots anger bubbled up, and so they started leveraging it. It's not that they send checks to local Tea Parties. 1,000 local Tea Parties were organized by these activists across the country. We did a web survey. They don't get a check from the Koch brothers. But what they do get is if they're intervening in a primary election campaign, for example, to do what just happened in Texas, which is to get behind Ted Cruz against a guy named David Dewhurst, who is very right-wing, but he wasn't apparently right-wing enough.
Right. Cast as a moderate by...
Right, and I don't think he did anything moderate. He might have talked to a Democrat once, but that's about it. But these outside forces like FreedomWorks and Americans for Prosperity, backed by the Koch brothers, they want to make sure Democrats wouldn't ever compromise with Obama or with Democrats. And so they send in money to those primaries. Well, that combination of grassroots activists worried about immigration and riled up to be angry at any Republican who's ever done any compromises in the past, and that outside money that can come in across the country, that does in one Republican conservative after another, and it terrifies all the rest of them in Washington. So that's why we've seen this pattern of Republicans being unwilling to compromise about anything, willing to drive the country to the edge of default at a cost of $1.3 billion to our economy. That's the latest estimate.
And you think the Tea Party is still very powerful, or has it lost a lot of its steam?
Well, it's lost its visibility because it became unpopular with the middle-of-the-road American by early 2011. So that means that Fox is no longer running a lot of pictures of older people with crazy signs in colonial costumes. But we have gone back and rechecked. We identified 1,000 groups in the spring of almost 1,000, about 900 active groups across the 50 states. And we went back to check to see how whether their websites were still active, indicating that they're still meeting, still doing things. And 2/3 of them were a year later, which would mean just a few months ago here. So I think they're still there. They're burrowing away, and they're focusing on making sure that Republicans either get elected to office or behave in office in a totally uncompromising way. So they're having a tremendous impact on the Republican Party. They're pulling it. I mean, so far right that political science measurements have never seen this in 50 years, the quantitative measurements.
And when you say pulling it right, what does that mean? Are they pro-life? Are they pro-super small government, which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with being pro-life? What does it mean to be far right?
Well, we found that about half of the grassroots Tea Partiers are also conservative Christians, which means for them, fighting abortion and gay marriage would be high priorities. All of the Tea Partiers agree on not giving any government money to the people they think of as the freeloaders or the moochers. So They're behind draconian cuts in things like Medicaid or job programs or food stamps. Food stamps is characterized as welfare. So are Pell Grants for needy college students. And remember, young people are also suspect in these circles.
Right.
But I would say that there's an irony here when you put the whole thing together. If they get elected, I think that the Freedom Works people and the Americans for Prosperity people are going to ram through a privatization of Social Security and Medicare. That's not something that grassroots Tea Partiers would want for themselves, but they might put up with doing it to younger Americans. So that would be the big blow on government spending, because that's where the you have to hunt where the ducks are if you want to cut the money in the federal government. And then there are huge tax cuts for the rich that are part of the agenda of the elite Tea Party groups. I don't know how grassroots people feel about that, but they don't oppose it.
Now, let's talk about Mitt Romney, who in so many ways, we could see it in the primary, not embraced, not loved by the conservative base. Why have they not gotten on board with Mitt Romney? In a lot of ways, he has sort of very conservative talking points.
Okay. Well, we interviewed grassroots Tea Partiers. It's the spring of 2011. At that point, it was wide open in the Republican primary, so we just asked them who was their favorite, and then we would hear what they had to say about the others. We found zero enthusiasm for Mitt Romney. I mean, I have to say that that would have been a point of agreement between liberal Massachusetts people and Tea Partiers at that point. But when we asked why, it wasn't, they didn't invoke policy positions. What they said was, he's not authentic. He's fake. He's not genuine.
Interesting. Some of the same criticism that you might hear from the left. It may not.
Well, in which the historical record demonstrates that this is a man who will say just about anything at any, and it changes. So they don't like him in that sense. And I'm sure, given what happened in the Republican primaries in 2012, that that never did get better in the sense that they were always looking for someone else. Now, they never found someone else. And even in 2011, I got the sense talking to grassroots people that in the end, whoever could go against Obama would be their horse. And Mitt Romney, of course, has now endorsed every Tea Party position. I mean, he literally fell over himself to be the most severe against immigrants, you may have noticed, in the primaries.
Absolutely, yes.
He's signed on to a tax cut for the rich agenda that, I mean, it makes all of the other candidates look moderate by comparison. And he's continuing to espouse this idea that he's going to get rid of Obamacare, even though it's the same thing as Romney Care, and Romney Care is his major public policy achievement. So I would say that Romney has gotten himself to the point where they will never trust him. They will vote for him. They will vote. Nobody should think that they won't just because they're not enthusiastic. If he's in office, they'll be pressuring him and they'll be watching him. And the they there is the grassroots Tea Partiers and the wealthy funders. And Grover Norquist said last spring, you know, Mitt Romney doesn't have to be inspiring. He just has to sign the bills that we're going to send him.
Right. So, interestingly, it sounds like the Tea Partiers have not embraced Mitt Romney, but Mitt Romney has embraced the Tea Partiers. He understands the agenda, and he's gotten on board.
Yes, and it isn't anything to do with whether Mitt Romney believes in that agenda. I don't think we know what Mitt Romney believes, because he's been so many places over the course of the last 15 years. But I think what everybody should understand is that something very radicalizing is happening in today's Republican Party. And this combination of grassroots anger and fear and big money that is trying to eviscerate American government as a tax and regulatory thing, that combination terrifies Republican officeholders and candidates and causes them to toe the line whether they believe it or not. And that has not, the events in Texas yesterday prove that that has not waned one bit.
So let's bring this up to today. We actually saw some very tough new polls for Romney this morning. In three big swing states, Obama seems to be doing really quite well. So Florida, 51 for Obama, 45 for Romney. Ohio, probably the other really crucial swing state, 50 for Obama, 44 for Romney. And then I'll throw Pennsylvania in because it's been put out there as a swing state, 53 for Obama, 42 for Romney. And that's new polling from the New York Times, CBS, and Quinnipiac. NBC's Chuck Todd was on Morning Joe this morning, and he looked at these numbers, which look awfully good for Obama, who, by the way, does not have super good approval ratings. People are not happy with the economy. They think it's getting worse or stagnating rather than getting better. And here was Chuck Todd's analysis of these numbers.
As the Tea Party has gotten stronger and the sort of the conservative wing of the party has gotten stronger inside the Republican Party, you've seen the numbers overall for the favorable rating of the Republican Party go down. And I think this is one of these untalked about pieces of baggage that Mitt Romney is carrying around that we don't spend enough time dealing with.
Theda Skocpol, professor at Harvard and author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. Are we missing the fact that the Tea Party is having an effect on the election as a whole?
Oh, it absolutely is. And I thought a lot of the commentary earlier this year was really off the mark. It would say, well, this is a Tea Party candidate, that's not a Tea Party candidate, and the one who isn't, we've decided, won. Well, that's just not the way to look at it. The way to look at it is the way Chuck Todd was hinting there, which is you need to look at what it's done to the position, to the brand, to the stance of the Republican Party. And let's leave aside liberal Democrats and Tea Partiers. Let's just leave them aside and talk about your middle of the road, slightly non-Tea Party Republican, maybe an independent, a moderate Democrat, occasionally conservative. They're concerned about the economy. They know it hasn't gotten enough better. They like Obama personally. They're not thrilled. But they look at, first of all, they look at Romney and who's personality just is not appealing. I mean, I don't think that's going to change. I just don't. But the other thing they look at is a Republican Party that's gone off the rails. And for the average voter, they may not know all the details of the policies, but they know that this is a kick-ass party that doesn't want to compromise and that was willing to do some pretty extreme things. And then they look at Romney, who seems to be pandering to the every extreme. And they probably, a lot of them, are wondering about that. So I think Todd is right. I think that's a contributing factor.
So, okay, so if you're Mitch McConnell in the Senate, or you're John Boehner, Speaker of the House, and you're thinking, you're looking at the big picture, you're not just looking at a race in Texas or this or that, and you're thinking, wow, the Tea Party is incredibly powerful. These people are motivated. They get to the polls. But on the other hand, they're having a really detrimental effect on moderates. What in the world do you do?
Well, there are no moderates left in the Republican Party. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, there are very conservative people, and now there are, just off the scale, non-compromising conservatives.
But the swing voters who might, always are waiting to see what they do.
No, right? And even in the ranks of Republican identifiers, I'm sure that these people in the Congress know very well that about half of those who label themselves Republican, we're not even talking about independents here, don't say they support the Tea Party. And therefore, for example, they would like to have some spending on environment. They'd like to have some spending on education. They don't care for the no-compromise stance. I think they're worried, and that's why you see McConnell and Boehner alike trying to do what they can. And it's not easy for Boehner in particular because he's got a huge caucus of these Tea Party people in the Congress. You see them trying to downplay certain kinds of hot button issues, making a deal not to have another standoff about closing down the government before the election, or trying to now stop talking about taking away contraception from women. That's a loser, and they know it. But I don't think that I still think they're trying to ride the horse. I mean, ride the tiger here, excuse me, wrong metaphor. Because they want the enthusiasm of these voters, particularly in congressional races. You know, it may not carry the day in the presidency, but in down-ballot races, the combination of a lot of ads paid for it by the Koch brothers to attack whatever Democrat it is in a congressional district, and enthusiastic people sure to go to the polls, that can tip the balance. So I don't think Boehner thinks he's going to lose his majority. I don't think he's going to. It'll be trimmed, but he won't lose it. And the Senate still seems in play to these guys.
And it sounds from what you're saying like we are really headed towards more polarization. You know, you said there are no moderates anymore. And we see, you know, one by one, people sort of say, I'm not going to run for re-election, or they lose a primary, or, I mean, we've seen people like Orrin Hatch, very, very conservative, wondering if he will be conservative enough for the Utah Republican primary.
Well, and what he did was to completely change all of his positions so that he never now would do what he used to do with Ted Kennedy, which is to work out a compromise. And in Indiana, we saw Richard Lugar offed by a man who will never compromise if he's elected. And we just saw that in Texas. Now, here's what I think will happen over time. I mean, I come from a profession, the political science profession, which tries to ignore all these realities and crunch a lot of numbers and say, well, whenever a party is off to one side, they're going to lose the next election and they'll come back to the middle. Well, that model certainly does not explain what's been happening to the Republican Party now for 15 years.
Right.
But the truth is that if Obama's reelected and they don't take the Senate and they lose some seats in the House,
they being
the Republicans,
okay,
that will cause a fight in the Republican Party. Now, it's not going to be pretty, and it won't be resolved fast, and there are hardly any moderate voices left, but they will speak up, and there will be a fight about why this happened. Now, I think a lot of conservatives and Tea Partiers are going to think it happened because of Mitt Romney.
Yeah, that he just wasn't the candidate they needed, not because of his views.
Well, and I think there is some uneasiness among very conservative commentators about the fact that he will not reveal his taxes. I mean, that's not necessarily an appealing thing in this crowd. So there'll be a fight. Now, if they sweep all three, they'll remake the United States in 3 months. They will not stop.
So they will so let's talk about if they could remake the United States, they would privatize Social Security, it sounds like. What else would they do?
Medicare and Social Security will both be privatized, not for people 55 and over. The Tea Party group will be exempt, but everybody else. The cuts that are being planned, it's the Paul Ryan budget, Wisconsin. They are unbelievably draconian. They would take American domestic spending on health care for the poor, national parks, food safety, everything the federal government does back to the level it was in 1942. That means there won't be much of any federal government anymore in America, and the amount of suffering that will be unleashed by that will be extraordinary. That'll all happen really fast. If they have all three.
And will anything happen with defense spending?
They're going to increase it.
Okay. Defense spending will increase. And then is your sense that
huge tax cuts,
okay, will come down at all levels?
Well, the plan that Paul Ryan has put forward that Romney has endorsed, and Romney has actually done a little more than this, but it has $4.3 trillion in domestic spending cuts, just like I described, and $4.2 trillion of that will be given away in additional tax cuts on top of the Bush tax cuts, benefiting the richest 5% of Americans.
Now, do people in the Tea Party, and I got this sense from your book, when you went to people's homes and you went to meetings, we were not talking about multimillionaires generally, right?
The elite Tea Partiers who are sloshing around the money.
Right.
They're
not
very wealthy.
Right.
But grassroots Tea Party people are just like everybody's grandma and grandpa. They're middle class people.
But are they okay with themselves paying, let's say, 20-25% in taxes and somebody who's much, much richer, like Warren Buffett pays 15-17% in taxes. Are they okay with themselves paying a higher rate, making, let's say, $60,000 a year?
I think they're amazingly don't understand that that's the plan.
Okay.
Of their elite allies. And I think they won't be happy with it when it happens, but I don't think they're going to stand in a way before it happens because they don't know. They don't have that information. And it wasn't my role in an interview with a grassroots person to say, well, here's the truth.
Sure, sure.
I didn't do that. That would have been arrogant and completely inappropriate and would have gotten a Harvard professor tossed out of into the cold.
This is a really interesting conversation, and it'll be fascinating to talk after the election and to see what has happened and what sort of new plans will be unveiled. We've been talking about the Tea Party, how they came about, who belongs to it, and how they're influencing the Republican Party. And I've been speaking with Theda Skocpol. She is the Victor S. Thomas Professor of Government and Sociology at Harvard, and her latest book is The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Last month, on the 4th of July, physicists cheered and popped champagne. And no, they weren't celebrating Independence Day. They were celebrating the discovery of a new subatomic particle, now famously known as the Higgs boson. But instead of merrymaking, should they have been mourning? Physicist Brian Green joins us to answer this question and to talk about the upcoming nail-biting Mars rover landing. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio.